Welcome to Discover Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and this is sort of part two of a three-part podcast, which I know it sounds kind of crazy. All right, the film Repatriation is a great film. It's available on Amazon Prime right now, and I highly recommend it. And the creative team behind Repatriation is Douglas Mueller and Ryan Barton Grimley. I already got to talk to Ryan. Now this podcast, I got to talk to Doug. I know it's not safe to assume you've already listened to the Ryan one, especially if you're a Douglas Mueller fan. But what can I say besides watch Repatriation on Amazon Prime, then listen to this great interview with Doug. And after that, you can listen to the interview where Doug and Ryan actually got on Skype with me at the same time, and we discussed the film, and we got to focus on their collaboration, which I thought was kind of cool. All right, here's Doug.
You know, it was a bunch of, you know, I'm sure as many filmmakers will say, they've got a bunch of ideas that are rattling around, and you know, you don't put anything to paper because it's, you know, it's worthy of thought, and you know, you're constantly contemplating things, and you know, real life is bouncing off of those ideas all the time. So I had when I was in high school, before I knew I wanted to be a filmmaker, when, you know, probably when my mom was trying to get me to be a chiropractor, and for some reason Stars, the cable channel, I think at the time it might have been called Encore or something, they played this movie called The Swimmer all the time at night, and I don't know what the deal was, but I happened to catch it. I was a product of Star Wars, so the idea of a film being, you know, a piece of art wasn't really on my radar. But I watched this movie all the time, and I just loved the broad strokes of it. A guy, there's a guy at the beginning who's, you know, a nice guy, and the community looks up to him, and then at the end, basically by no real fault of his own, people don't like him, and I love that. And so, you know, that was always kind of in the back of my head as I went about doing all kinds of other projects. And so,
right, other projects, or that actually got you into filmmaking, like in high school?
No, I think what happened in high school was I was really into ER. I loved the show ER. I thought it was great. I loved anatomy class. I was reading all these Michael Crichton books about being a doctor and stuff, and I was totally into this. And then I was on a flight once with a guy who was a real doctor, and he sat next to me, and I was telling him about my life and what I was interested in, and he told me the story about how the first time before he was a doctor, he, you know, helped this woman give birth, and it was just this unbelievable experience. And everything he said did not relate to anything that I thought. And I thought, oh man, this is, maybe being a doctor is really not for me. And at the same time, I'm my best friend at the time, we were talking about this movie Species. And at the time, I think this girl sold the script for Species on a spec script. And this blew our minds. Like, this was unbelievable. She, you know, she made a ton of money off of it, and it seemed like a pretty straightforward movie. And so, all these kinds of things were happening at the same time. Then it occurred to me that I really didn't want to be a doctor. I really liked the TV show of ER.
And right. You like the show more than right, the topic of the show.
Right. Right. And so kind of from that point on, like it occurred to me that, oh, well, of course I should love to make movies. You know, as a kid, I made movies all the time, playing with toys. I'm drawing pictures constantly. I love comic books. The idea of storyboarding seemed like a natural evolution. And so I did a couple of, you know, stupid VHS projects with my buddy there before, you know, I was still in school. I was in college. I was just taking generals. And then I decided to move out to California and deliberately go to a school that had a film program. And that's, you know, and I think that's when things got serious, so to speak. I don't think I didn't do anything of note. I don't know anything. We didn't even finish a project. I think we shot stuff and, you know, I don't know.
Right, before school, you just played around, but you didn't even really end up with a thing to share.
Right. Yeah, absolutely nothing.
But what school did you go to?
California State University, Monterey Bay.
Oh, nice.
Which is,
right.
The school was founded in 1994. It was a very small state school. And the fact that I picked him, I'd never really been to Monterey before, but it was a small school, and that I just didn't want to be, I didn't want to be one of 1,000 kids in a program. It just, you know, I grew up in the Midwest, and I like a personable relationship. So that they have, like, you know, so at the time there was, you know, like 89 students in the program or something, and I loved it. I went all out. I never worried about graduation until they started telling me that I need to start graduate. I just took all the, you know, there's a documentary class. Oh, great. I'll take it. There's a video class. I'll take it. A film class. I'll take it. I just took everything I could, and I loved it. And,
right. So, so at the end you actually had to cram in the classes it took to finish.
Yeah, totally. Like my last year and a half had nothing to do with film classes. It was just, you know, here's these things that you should have been doing the whole time.
Right. The stuff that they normally want you to get out of the way in the first like year or two.
Right.
It doesn't matter when you do it though.
Yeah, no. And it wasn't, but you know, of course it was like bizarre to be, you know, I did 2 years in North Dakota before I did 5 years out here. So suddenly, you know, I'm like, 22 or 23 in 100 level classes with all these like 18-year-old kids, and you know, that was fun. But
cool. And then I'm gonna assume it's a pretty good program, because you obviously learned a lot there.
Yeah, one of the great things about the school there was exactly what I aimed for. It was a small school. They had a ton of, they were new, so they had a ton of equipment. You know, they got like 5 Avid machines, and I mean, this sounds stupid, but at the time they had a digital beta camera, and you know, that was cutting edge at the time.
It makes perfect sense that it sounds very like a very practical program. So
it was almost like a trade school. Like I got some friends who went to NYU and had, you know, have very legitimate Hollywood careers, and they're blown away by the amount of stuff I did in school. Like I actually shot stuff in school, and I didn't appreciate how cool that was until I made friends who went to other schools, and they were like, wow, you've shot 3 things and they were on film, and it just wasn't their experience. Despite having, you know, a very prestigious
title. A lot of film schools are so theoretical, and so
right.
It's more like film studies than filmmaking.
Which at the time, like, you know, like 20 years ago for, you know, my generation, they started making like audio commentary on DVDs. I'm not saying like a theoretical education isn't important, but you could kind of get it in the film world by just listening to audio commentaries and seeing how they make movies and, you know, watching all these special features that weren't available, you know, 4 or 5 years earlier.
It's not that a film education, film history and stuff and semiotics and all kinds of things. I don't even know what they mean. I'm sure that has value, but you need to know how to make you need to know how to tell a story too.
And like learn the pressures of 10 people all staring at you on set. Like, you know, that's real. Well, you know, waiting for a bunch of people to, you know, not waste their time is not something you can be taught by reading a bunch of stuff or, you know, you really have to be doing, you know, these things to learn about how hard it is in a, you know, emotional, logistical way to, you know, how do you manage 10 people? I mean, this is, you know, a small scale production, but you got, you know, 10 people are counting on you. And, you know, I thought that was very, very valuable at the time. At the time, I of course didn't appreciate it, but now I see like, oh, wow, I got to do a lot in college comparatively. That were, yeah, you know, definitely. Life skills.
Definitely. And so after school, what came after?
Well, I did my senior film, played at a couple festivals, which I was totally proud of, because it wasn't like in the student category or whatever. It was just, you know, a film at a film festival. So that was very cool. And so just out of habit, basically the next step was to make a short. And so a buddy of mine, and I, you know, started working on shorts and, you know, getting a little group of friends together and, you know, producing those things. I did a short, Four Corners, which, did pretty well on the festival circuit. And, I played up the, Science Fiction Short Film Festival at the Science Fiction, Hall of Fame in Seattle and got second place. And I think from there, we managed to get a distribution deal out of it, which, I was just, you know, we were taught in school that you're going to do shorts as a learning experience, and no one ever gets distribution on a short.
After that unusual success.
Yeah, so I produced that with wrote it with a friend of mine, Dusty Bias, who we then started working on a feature that he wrote, and I started storyboarding for, and then we shot this feature, Repatriation. Prayer Love. And it was his first feature as a director and writer, and I think as producers too. It was our first go. We went back. We grew up in North Dakota, in a small town. Well, they're all small towns in North Dakota, but but comparatively, it's a big town in North Dakota. But
aren't there a couple of boom towns from the oil scene?
Oh, totally, dude. Oh, my mom could tell you all kinds of terrible stories. But yeah, and ours was one of them. Minot grew a lot during the oil boom. And anyway, so we shot. We produced this feature film up there, Prairie Love, with just like three or four characters and this beautiful landscape and backdrop of the plains in the winter. And it was a big hit. It got into Sundance, and after you get in Sundance, every festival in America wants you to screen there. So we had a great festival run after that and won a bunch of awards. And we got right out of Sundance, we got a deal for distribution through Film Movement. And so it played, I think on Netflix for a couple of years, and I think it's, I should look this up. I people keep asking about it, and I don't actually know where you can watch it now. You probably on Hulu and Netflix or Amazon.
Once it's out of your hands, sometimes it's hard to keep track of that stuff.
Yeah. And it's weird because they don't really tell you what's going on. You know, it would be, it's strange because like I'd be happy to help like promote it and stuff if you gave me a countdown or something. I mean, even Repatriation's kind of going like that. Like, we know they got it. It got up on Amazon, which was awesome. Although we didn't, we knew it was coming, but we didn't know when it was. So, our marketing efforts are, kind of chasing trying to get the ball rolling,
right,
as
the tail's
is released.
Kind of wagging the dog on that.
Right.
One.
Yeah, exactly. So,
I'm going to tease you briefly and say, so you were like, after that feature, you're like, yeah, this filmmaking thing is kind of a breeze. I mean, you make stuff and people put it out there.
Yeah, it was, oh man, if I could have a conversation with me now then. Yeah, it was, I knew the movie was great, and I had a feeling it would do very well because it felt like a very, unique looking and feeling movie. But yeah, so to get that movie and get it out and have so much success, it was, moving past that was pretty weird. And one thing that I think none of us did very well who were part of that team was, put a plan moving forward. And all this time and attention was given to finishing Prairie Love, but we didn't really have an idea or a strategy about how to capitalize on that going forward. So, in many ways we kind of started from scratch after that. And I'm still, friends with, Dusty, their director, and, working on things in some respects. But at the time, I finished doing Prairie Love and like going to festivals and seeing, I don't really go to festivals unless I've got a movie showing for some reason. And so when you go, when you get that movie showing, you get to see a bunch of other work, and it's fascinating because you see what everybody else is doing. And I noticed, and even being at Sundance, that I felt like a lot of, there seemed to be like a common thread in independent films. And I really wanted to do something that felt like the opposite of that. So one thing that I noticed, and actually some of the better, maybe this is a bad strategy, but some of the better films seem to only have a couple characters and seem to be very narrowly focused in kind of their narrative. And so when I sat down after Prairie Love went to Sundance, I was trying to, first of all, finish all the stupid ideas I hadn't finished. And among that was, writing Repatriation. I thought I wanted to make this the opposite of a prairie love. I want it to feel like it's a big world. I want to feel like there's a lot of people. I want it to feel like, the movie is about a guy, you know, going back home for, you know, arguably the holidays or something, like, you know, kind of like last weekend for Thanksgiving or coming up at Christmas and New Year. Everyone kind of flocks back to their hometowns and is reunited with a bunch of people. And I had done this a few times, having moved away from my hometown. I really wanted to try to do something that felt like that, that seemed like it was, you know, you're just running, you're just seeing people, you know, nonstop who are from different parts of your life, but are still, you know, part of your life and part of, like, you know, this wide experience, as opposed to like a narrow experience. So right. So I'm writing all these kind of conversations in some ways that are, you know, the opposite of what they tell you in film school, which is, you know, stay on point and all the, you know, if it's not moving the story forward, it's, you don't need it. And I was cognizant of that, but I knew that that wasn't the kind of, I couldn't do that with this. This was about, alluding to things that we don't see and alluding to things that aren't on screen. And so that was a big driver in why I started writing Repatriation. Then I shared it with Ryan he shares his scripts with him. You know, it wasn't like, here's this movie that I want us to make. It was just a regular, I finally just finished this thing. Could you read it for me? And Ryan and I, and I've got a couple of friends who we do this with. And it was many months later that Ryan's like, dude, you know, I really like this thing and we should try to make this. And that was crazy because I initially cast Ryan in my short Four Corners, and he had like a family crisis the weekend of the shoot. So we had to hurry up and recast. So we were always kind of like frustrated collaborators and that we hadn't gotten to work together. So when he mentions that he liked the script and that we should try to make it together, I thought, okay, well, I'm going to go all in on this. Cause I felt we had a couple other opportunities that didn't pan out. So I wanted to make sure that we got to work together in a serious capacity.
Right. That's cool. And going back a little, it sounds like your inspiration in writing Repatriation had a lot to do with, like you said, doing something differently than those other indies. And so, So you didn't start with the Stolen Valor thing. You started with the Homecoming idea.
Definitely. Yeah. The Stolen Valor elements. I guess this is the assumption that you've seen the movie.
The assumption the assumption is, you know, there will be a link for people to watch it on Amazon. And there's, the intro to every podcast is you really are supposed to watch the movie first so that you can really appreciate, because if they watch it first and then listen to you, it's way better.
I would hope so. I hope so. So yeah, but that's it. I was really enamored with the, what's the other great example? A Christmas Story. I love, you know, Mr. Scrooge is this, you know, bad guy who becomes a nice guy at the end. And in reality, he doesn't do a whole lot throughout the whole movie or the story. He's just following other people who are showing him things and explaining things to him. And we're seeing other characters kind of flesh out the character, not the character himself, the protagonist himself. So I love this. I thought this was great. And it wasn't until, basically, the last piece of the puzzle that made me go, "Oh, I've got it now. This is a story." My cousin married a gentleman who was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor, and so I got to go to the White House and see Obama give him the thing, and it was amazing. And that night, we were all just sitting around a table and talking about, you know, the day and how crazy it was. And he said something to the effect of, started telling us about how he was the first Medal of Honor recipient, living Medal of Honor recipient, to get the award since Vietnam. I mean, it'd been decades since a living guy had gotten it, and the first from Afghanistan. So they really kind of tried to instill in him the full scope of responsibilities, and that there'd be a lot of pressure and all these things. And of the things they mentioned is that if you want to go out and get a drink with your buddies, you need to know that everyone's going to want to buy you a drink. And that if you do that for the next 30 years of your life, you know, you're going to be an alcoholic with liver cancer. and he said this, and this just like, this hit me like a, I was like, oh my God. So I've got two things, you know, it was these two things that happened. The first of which is it occurred to me that there's a through line now. So I wanted my character to visit different places and to see a bunch of different people. And so the idea of a returning soldier, getting offered drinks, everywhere he goes was perfect because it provides a story for every location. Everyone's going to treat him with a drink. In the swimmer, the whole premise of him being a swimmer was he was trying to get back to his house, by using people's swimming pools. So he lived in this ritzy neighborhood. So he was visiting people who would have a pool so he could jump in their pool and swim home. And, so this provided me, you know, kind of the parallel thing, like, oh, okay, well, he'd go from place to place and he'd totally get drinks. And then at the same moment, it also occurred to me, that he's in the military. So he, you know, just like in society now, there's a bottom level of respect and understanding for a guy who's in the military. In the middle of, right before production too, my wife and I were living in an apartment complex, and there's a couple little military outposts here where I live in California, and a guy moved in next door to us, and this wouldn't mean one thing or the other than we regularly heard him, you know, screaming and possibly, you know, beating his girlfriend. So I had a newborn baby at home, and all I think is, you know, this is just a matter of time before, you know, a bullet comes flying through the, you know, one of my walls and hits my kid in the head. And so, you know, we call 911 and we make sure, you know, when things felt like they were getting out of hand and it gets really noisy next door, the cops came and, you know, it was just another kind of example of, you know, on the surface, you know, he first moves in and, you know, we see past him in the common areas, you know, it's a, hey, thank you for your service. And, you know, Obama, you know, not genuflect quite, but, you know, hey, you know, thank you. And here you go. And here's the right of way. And then, you know, within a couple of weeks, we realize, well, this guy's a complete asshole. And it doesn't matter what he puts on when he goes to work in the day. He's coming back and, you know, screaming and beating his girlfriend. So, you know, why do I need to treat him with respect when I see him out in the street? I object to that.
But as a filmmaker, to your credit, you knew better than to make that your story. Because right. You actually made your flawed guy not at all.
Right. And that was, and I have to say, that was something that wasn't necessarily right off the bat. Like in the first couple versions, maybe even that I sent Ryan, at first, I wasn't really sure where that landed. I wanted it, you know, my first versions, he was in the military, and I had these things where he was, you know, he was dishonorably discharged, or he was kicked out for, you know, war crimes or something. And then I started to realize that I was slightly out of my element, and I'm not familiar enough with the military or, you know, these protocols to, I mean, I asked my relatives and things like this, but I was never getting the answers I thought that were good for telling the story in a good way. I mean, it just seemed like it was turning into a story about the military, and I didn't want it to be, a referendum on, you know, domestic violence in the military. That wasn't the kind of movie I was trying to make. So it was always in the back of my head, well, maybe he's not. And, you know, and I said to Ryan, well, maybe we shouldn't even touch these other subjects since we're not doing a very good job at it. Maybe, and I shouldn't drag him into it, as my script. But you know, maybe we should just have it as him just being totally full of shit the whole time. And that seemed to be, both the most rewarding, because it seemed like the biggest arc is to not just have him like a shameful military guy, but just let's just say he wasn't even in at all. And that seemed like it solved a lot of like structural problems. And, you know, like if I were to, you know, like if he got dishonorably discharged and got sent back home, I would just imagine that a certain amount of people would know that. Like if he's from a small town, suddenly that would be a very newsworthy event. And I didn't want the character to be in a situation where everyone knew about him. I wanted the character to be kind of flying under the radar and implementing these things, like making him actually in the military, doing these other things, kind of screwed that up. So that's why we took that out.
Yeah. You're telling me that you, at the screenwriting stage, you're extremely thoughtful about your material. You're not flipping at all. You're looking really deep into it. You're considering it from every possible angle. You know, you're looking at it in you're screenwriting in a very whole way. And so you came up with something that when you say it solved a lot of problems, I mean, it not only did it solve problems, but it gave you something really timely and appropriate too.
Yeah, and I felt like in a tighter movie. I mean, I wanted to stay on theme, and I wanted to, you know, not deviate too much from sending the kind of messages I wanted to send, and those were the kind of problems it was causing. Like it was just branching out too far thematically from, you know, why I first started sitting down writing the thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm just trying to compliment you that you're such Thank a you. that you're that you're that you're a writer who, you know, one thing that always bugs me about some writers is they love the smell of their own farts, you know?
right.
And you sniffed them out and said, I'm not gonna settle for this. I'm gonna keep working on it.
Yeah, it was a lot of that, and you know, through post production as well. I mean, we after principal photography, you know, when we cut it together and we saw what worked and what didn't, it was in many ways a lot of fun to kind of go back and write. We rewrote the first scene and then inserted another scene later. And it was so much fun to be able to exercise some storytelling. And, you know, I've been boxed in for, you know, a year, and I thought, oh man, look, I can say this and I can say this, and we can finally kind of dabble in that. And then it was a lot of fun to be able to kind of, you know, tie up some things in a way that it was really hard. You know, principal photography, we, you know, essentially removed a whole scene that kind of established a lot of stuff. And so to be able to rework that in a way that was consistent, but a little more exciting was a lot of fun.
Right. So you were able to shoot it and then do a cut and see everything that you would like to add. And I kind of know this from talking to Ryan first.
but then you
really did it the service of putting in the extra effort.
Yeah, and I, in the spirit of that, I got to give Ryan, you know, buckets full of praise, because as a director and writer, it's there's a certain amount of, you know, the whole culture of filmmaking. I think in many ways, you know, you hear somebody's doing reshoots or pickups or something, and you go, oh man, that's not good. That's bad news. And I have to say, I partially agree with it, but I also really appreciate, going back to DVDs 20 years ago, I'll never forget, as a product of Star Wars, and they're talking about, you know, how they have scheduled, pickup shooting 6 months after principal photography, and that usually is scheduled, but they scheduled it for 2 weeks instead of just one. And because it was I don't want to sit here and heap praise on George Lucas, especially around episode one, although his filmmaking style, he says well, I'm going to embrace this rather than run from it. And that really resonated with me. I thought, wow, this is brilliant. But not everybody thinks that way. So to be able to go to Ryan and go, hey, dude, you know, this scene really doesn't work. You know, we casted guys in their 70s, and you know, they're not up for, you know, this 15 minute scene. It's too long. It's not exciting enough. This is the hard way to start the movie. You know, to have his blessing and enthusiasm to correct that is amazing. I mean, this is, you know, I'm trembling as I'm trying to say, like, I think we should reshoot this, and for him to go, oh, totally, we could totally do that is, I got to hand it to him for, you know, for his attitude. I mean, he's always a positive guy, but to right.
that. So, not so be you're appreciating your, you know, really your the fact that he is willing to invest the time and effort that you're willing to invest. I mean, you guys were on the same page with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously if somebody, yeah, I mean, if a lot of independent films do not have the luxury of doing some pickups.
Which is crazy for me. I think like I, you know, in talking to Ryan about it, you know, I do a variety of other productions elsewhere other than independent film. And as you know, I think people who do this kind of work are well aware that, you know, there's good, fast, and cheap, but you can pick two. And being an independent filmmaker, cheap is always that's the constant. So I have either good or fast, and fast isn't important to me. I really want to make something I'm proud of. And so as independent filmmakers, I feel like this is what we have. We have time, even though everyone's anxious to get a career and all that stuff in terms of the product. You know, time is the best thing that we have. And I think Ryan also appreciated that there wasn't, you know, he didn't say, well, dude, you know, we shot this a year ago. How come we're not done already?
Yeah. Besides him being a great person to work with, when your lead actor is a producer and involved with, you know, and involved in the edit, that's a heck of a luxury, huh? Because if it was a, you know, another actor who you'd hired and had to pay him by the day rate and whatnot, I mean, it could have been a big hassle to get your talent on camera again.
Yeah. No, there's huge advantages to, you know, every time, you know, sometimes the things are not going well at the film and I get stressed out, and then and Ryan will save the day. And on one hand, I think like, oh, dude, thank God he is, you know, such a great guy. But then I always think like, oh, you idiot. It's his mug too. He wants it to. You know, he's just as invested, if not more, than I am, because it's his face.
He's on camera about every second of the film, except a couple times when he walks out of a room and you see people's reactions to his leaving. But yes, he is. Yeah, so he would clearly want it to be as good as possible. The funny thing is at what point did you guys stop doing reshoots? Because obviously there must have been a temptation to like, okay, this scene we could bump up, or we could throw something in between these two. But right. It took a little bit of discipline, I assume, to stop if he had access to the camera. Because at a certain level, you can make do with, you know, the two of you could have gone on forever adding little bits.
Yeah, yeah. And that's – and, you know, I never wanted to put him under that impression. I was kind of scared of making him think that, you know, like this whole – like the whole shoot was all in pencil and let me just try to go back and do this in pen. but he was very cool. And I have to say, like, even some of, like, we did, one of the pickup days we did with with Ari, the pickle scene, was, myself. I think I was running, the audio, and, our second unit DP, Sean Ayers was running the camera, and it was literally just the four of us, Ryan, Ari, myself, and Sean. In the Nature Store Market in Oakland. And, to be able to scale down to that small with, the actor / producer and his brother-in-law makes it really easy to, squeeze out a couple extra shots when you need them.
and, you know, to your credit, you know, did Ryan do anything to like match his hair and everything in wardrobe, or was it just, Because it is seamless. Is seamless that, you know, no one would guess that those scenes were 6 months later or, you know, however much later.
No, you're totally getting to why we stopped. We never planned on shooting anything else. But, like, when we did see, like, oh, we're going to shoot this thing up in Oakland, you know, we were, like, a month out. And Ryan's like, oh, Jesus, I need to lose some weight. And
he got in shape for it in the first place, right? So it sort of
right. Yeah, he totally did. He totally did. So he had to match that at some level. And so, you know, he starved himself for a month. And although we never planned on it, it was just a joke. Like, dude, you can't do this again. I can't spend that much time.
Yeah, how long can you go without pizza and spaghetti and ice cream?
Well, I was telling his wife, like, hey, thank me for, you know, getting him in shape, because otherwise, you
know, he got a little pretty for a while.
Right.
That's funny.
Yeah. Yeah, he was cool about it. Ryan's been wonderful the whole process.
Yeah. Well, so that's cool. So then you guys did that. And, is there anything else from, it's funny because Ryan told me, you know, my plan is to have you guys listen to each other and then maybe the three of us will have like a funny talk. But he got really in depth with like how it was your grandparents' house or your and you guys just it sounded like actually a really good onset camaraderie sort of offer for all thing.
One reason we chose to shoot in Iowa is I had a bunch of family there and I was leveraging all their help against the film. So my grandmother had just I think a year before moved into a home. She's in her 90s. So she was getting ready to get rid of her house, and it was a nice big house. There was a big Iowa family. My dad's got six brothers and sisters. So we had this huge house that we used for one location, but the rest of the time, all of the crew and all of the cast stayed there, and this was a rotating group of people. You know, we got a lot of our principal cast from Chicago, and they would do, you know, one or two nights for a scene, and so there was a constant turnover. We joked that it was like a barracks because they had a huge downstairs basement, and it was all wide open, and there was like seven air mattresses and everyone had a little section, and we go and shoot and come back, and you know, we'd sit at the dining table that I sat and had, you know, 15 Thanksgiving dinners at, and you know, my dad would be there and we'd all have drinks, and it was it's weird because in some ways I don't know it any other way. I've been just making things in this capacity for a long time, but it was very nice. And, you know, despite horror stories you hear about other situations, you know, everyone was so very cool. It was a great group. We just had a screening last weekend in Iowa, and seeing all the Iowa people again was just, it was great. They were, you know, all these people really stepped up and were really just super helpful. And the whole time it was really nice. Nice to see him again.
Yeah, and I would think housing everyone that way, I would assume that decreased the stress levels too, because it wasn't like, you know, not that you guys wanted to go miss your schedule or anything, but it wasn't like, oh my God, we lose the house in 2 weeks, or this happens or that happens.
Right.
I mean, it sounds like it just made it for a more positive feeling all around.
Yeah, and you know, everyone's, for better or worse, maybe people would say worse, but you know, in the mornings or nights, because we were shooting nights, you know, there's only so many bathrooms in the house, and at a certain point, you know, you're carrying your toiletries in and out and saying hi to the next person waiting, and you know, and 45 minutes after that, we were all packing into the same cars to drive to set. So yeah, it made it very. Very nice. And you know, many of the people we had worked with before, except for the actors, so a lot of those people were new, to me. And, but you know, everyone was, it was very cool. I mean,
it sounds really kind of collegiate.
Yeah. I guess so. It was a good group of people. I mean, making a movie is not fun. I think we also you know, everyone got passed around the flu at one point. I don't think anybody got out of production without, you know, like throwing up or something. I don't know. Some got into our food like the first day and we all passed it around. And so I think that like humbled everybody a little bit too, perhaps.
Yeah, geez. that could have blown up in your face. You know, you didn't mention it. You didn't mention the flu.
It was awful.
Sounds like it. All right, cool. So that covers the shooting of it and the reshoots and whatnot. And then what came after? Like, did you – after – so you premiered at Film Invasion LA, mm-hmm. which is, again, really kind of cool.
Yes.
And then you hit a bunch of festivals after?
Yeah, did a couple of other festivals and other competitions that don't necessarily have screenings. So it was kind of hard to keep track of. It was a very busy couple months after that. And then kind of all culminating in, you know, a couple months later, we signed this distribution deal and then went to the Cinema Lounge and screened there for a week. In LA, which was great. I mean, to be able to, a bunch of cast and crew were out here. Some people came back from Chicago. So to be able to share that, I guess at this level, at this independent film level, I feel like, it's not, all mine by any measure. And you know, everyone's kind of counting on me to finish it so they could see all their hard work because everyone else's contributions for their time was all engrossing as well. So yeah, to be able to show it, in the last couple months has been, wonderful. And the Q&As, are just so rewarding because, I can't be the judge of whether it's any good or not, but I'm very proud of all the effort I put into the script. And I felt like I put in a lot. So these great Q&A moments, you know, 3 years after principal photography or 6 years after the script was written for that matter, is like the coolest thing. Like that people are picking up on these clues and it's amazing how so many different, you know, so you'll get five different questions about little things. I feel like that gives people a value afterwards. That makes the Q&A interesting. That makes you want to talk to it about, you know, with your friend who you watched it with, or, you know, it's, I'd like to think it's not just something you fold up and go, oh, okay, that's good. And done, that it makes a conversation is friggin' awesome.
Yeah. Well, that is one of the really great things you do is it is really subtle. And the slow turn, the slow revelation of the truth. I mean, I think in my mind's eye, right? It's the brother of his ex-girlfriend mm-hmm. shooting pool. Like that's kind of the first. That's like the first hint that wait a minute, he shouldn't even be wearing that.
Right, right.
But
it's my favorite scene.
Is that your favorite scene? That one's really good. Yeah, that's where the menace is really starting to kick in. But really right up until the end, I think that lady would have an argument if she just kind of looked away when the father says something to him along those lines.
Right.
There's an argument up to that point that he's not – that you can't be 100% certain.
Yeah.
But I think after the dad's comment and then, of course, like I told you at Film Invasion LA, finally seeing it on the big screen –
I know what you're gonna say is
the baseball jersey. I'm like, oh, the baseball jersey says Tyler and his uniform says Taylor, so it's totally he bought it at a used clothing store and it's not even
I love that, and you can't see
that unless you know, I wonder if I watched it on like, you know, like a 50-inch TV, if you can see it. But you definitely can't see it, you know, when you're watching on a computer, which is unfortunately with film festivals, you're like watching everything on Vimeo.
Right, right. Yeah, and one of my faults, I really, you know, shooting a movie cinematically just seems like, you know, is where my intuition goes. And you know, the idea of not doing an insert that, you know, spelled like the idea, you know, being able to, as an audience member, to see the whole screen and take the clues from there. For better or worse, I often think of doing that on a big screen, and that, you know, that's when it's going to pay off the best, and that's where it's going to be, you know, not feel forced or something.
No, an insert of that wouldn't have worked. And honestly, now I think, I'm sure there's people who've caught it on a smaller screen. I'm sure.
I think so. You know, somewhat related though, I can't help but think of this. One of the questions I had at a Q&A last week in Iowa was, a woman asked why it ends so abruptly. She really got me. So of course it screwed with me for the last week. Like, why do my films end so abruptly? But I think it was to what you were saying a moment ago that, you know, we were very patiently trying to give these clues. We were very, you know, at no point did I want it to feel jarring. I didn't want it to, you know, I wanted us to gradually get to the position where we were at. And honestly, I felt like by the way the last scene, provides us with like all the, like, I don't want to give any more clues. Like, I'm out of clues. And, you know, if it ends abruptly, you know, I felt like, you know, my answer to that woman and the answer in my head was that I don't want to drag on this movie any longer. If you've got all the information you need, the story, you know, the story is ended in terms of the main character's journey, as well as my ability to, you know, just deliver some clues and some context. I had nothing else I wanted to say that wasn't, by the way, he's not in the military. And that's the last thing I wanted to do. Like, I didn't want to, I wanted to leave some ambiguity.
I have to tell you, I've had people recently say that one of the coolest things is when a film can spark debate. And I would debate her about it being abrupt. I don't think it's an abrupt ending.
Well, thank you. It surprised me a little. Screwed with me.
It's a one evening film. It's one night, and he's three sheets to the wind, and he's about to lay in bed. So what? Are you going to show him laying in his childhood bed for like 2 minutes, and then slowly fade to black? It's like it's over. The night is over. Showing him waking up the next morning, having coffee with his dad and being regretful for what he did would be the worst ending I could think
of. Right. Totally.
It's like his father said, one of these days you're really going to get beaten for doing this. And then that's all you needed.
Right.
So
totally.
She's just wrong.
Yeah, I'll agree.
She's as wrong as a lady who didn't pick up that he wasn't military.
God, I don't know how you can get that at this point.
No,
but you know, like you said, you're not paying attention for a couple moments, and maybe. I mean, I have to say, like, for better or worse, I do feel like. I want to watch the kind of movie where it matters that you're paying attention, and so as a result, that's the kind of movie I want to make. And so, you know, if you're doing the dishes and other things while you're watching the movie, you're probably going to hate it. So, you know, but I don't know. I don't know if I want to win you over if you don't want to sit and watch it.
So what are you? What is next for you now that this one is finally it's released? It's got its digital release.
Yeah, I've, you know, as probably every filmmaker, you know, you've got a bunch of stuff in the hopper, you know, waiting for the one thing to grab or whatever. The thing I'm spending a lot of time on that I'm really excited about is I shot a short documentary, experimental doc, about the last five space shuttle launches. And so I went out there. I'm not a big... I'm not into like professional sports or things like this, but I recognize that America is crazy about this stuff. And so I went to a space shuttle launch. The first one I went to, I loved it. Was, you know, it was like this big tailgate party for science. Everyone, you know, flocks to Cape Canaveral and brings their barbecue and their needlepoint and hangs out until the thing launches. And I just loved this. I thought this was great. So I shot, basically, this a documentary on the you know, kind of the tailgate party of a space shuttle launch, including, of course, watching the shuttle go off. So I shot it all on Kodachrome film. And at the time when I started, Kodachrome was all going to be, it was going to be retired, at the end of 2010. And so was the space shuttle. The space shuttle at the time was scheduled to send their last, shuttle up, November of 2010. So I had this thing where I was wildly excited and proud that I thought, here's this movie that I've got where the subject and the medium, are related. They're, you know, both these, like iconic American scientific institutions, that are kind of being wrapped up and kind of closing, you know, closing shop.
I got to tell you, we talked for about 45 minutes, maybe even an hour, about that documentary he shot of the space shuttle launches on Kodachrome. It's amazing. I really hope he gets it made. I really hope they figure out how to recreate the Kodachrome process. I got to tell you, there should be a documentary about that documentary because it's just fascinating all around. So there you have it. Part two of the repatriation trilogy of podcasts. First one with lead actor and producer Ryan Barton Grimley. Second one with writer-director Doug Mueller. And after this one, will be both of them with me on Skype. All right, so go to Amazon Prime and watch Repatriation, so this will all be worthwhile. And I have to tell you, you should also go to discoverfilm.net to see all kinds of great shorts, to find links to good film festivals like the Sherman Oaks Film Festival and Film Invasion LA. You can even learn about me, your host. And I think that's all. Thanks for listening.